Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It is the pod of thunder and rock and roll. And let's do it. The Duff McKagan joke of the week.
Chris Jericho, Duff McKagan here. I was in a bar earlier, and this man walked in, and he took off his backpack and he put it on the bar, and he took out a little piano out of the backpack, and then he took out a little man who started playing this piano beautifully. Well, the bartender was blown away, and he's like, "Where did you get this little man?" And the guy with the backpack, you know, pulled out a genie's lamp. He said, "Well, just rub this and ask for anything you want." And the bartender's like, "Okay." He rubs it and says, "I'd like $1 million." And poof, $1 million with a D walk through the door. And the bartender looks at the man and says, "You know, something's your lantern's broken." He goes, "Yeah. Do you think I actually asked for a 10-inch pianist? Thank you very much. Goodbye."
That's a good one. I like that. I don't know if I've heard that before, but it's always fun with Duff's slightly confused delivery. Great guy, and thank you, Duff, for calling in an amazing joke every Friday for the last almost 3 years. We started this in August of 2017. So thanks to Duff for doing that. And thanks to Bruce Kulick for joining us on the new quarantine tune, a cover of the classic Kiss song, kind of obscure, from the Revenge record called Heart of Chrome. Even though No 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 is in the top 60 in America right now on the mainstream rock charts, this is the second song that we've released. This got even more of a buzz than No 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 did due to the inclusion of Bruce Kulick joining us. So here it is, once again, the second single from Quarantine. It's Heart of Chrome right here on the Talk is Jericho.
Oh, but now my world's gone crazy.
That's the new single from Quarantine, Heart of Chrome, with Bruce Kulick on guitar. It's out now. You can get it on iTunes, Amazon, Spotify, wherever you get your music. You can, of course, check the video out on YouTube as well. Where else, when else, but in a pandemic, can you start a 80s non-makeup Kiss cover band with the guitar player from Kiss? That's what we're doing with Quarantine. And what we're doing every Saturday night, great segue, is a Saturday night special on YouTube Live and Facebook Live with me. Yes, hanging out with all of you. So get your questions and answers ready and your drinks and your sing-along song ideas, because we're back live tomorrow night, Saturday night, once again on Facebook Live and on my YouTube channel at 9 p.m. Eastern. So we'll see you then. Maybe we'll do a Nickelback sing-along, because today it's apropos, because I've got Chad Kroeger and his brother and bassist Mike Kroeger and guitarist Ryan Peek are here from Nickelback. And let me remind you about a couple of things before you say anything. Nickelback has sold over 50 million records. Think about that. They've sold out Madison Square Garden. They've been nominated for 6 Grammys, including Album of the Year. And they rank as the second best-selling foreign act of the 2000s in the States, behind only the Beatles. Think about that for a bit. We're going to talk about some of the hate they've dealt with over the years. We're also going to talk about their incredible success. You'll find out how and why they signed in 1999 with Roadrunner Records, which at the time was known as an extreme metal label. I think they had King Diamond and Slipknot on the label. And the job that Mike had that inspired their band name. They got some crazy road stories. This was taped backstage when Fozzy and Nickelback toured last year. So it's been in the can for a while, as we say. But we had a great time touring with Nickelback. They're great guys. Of course they're great. They're Canadian. And they've got some great stories for all of you. And when the pandemic is over and we can go see shows again, you got to go see Nickelback. They put on an amazing show. We had so much fun touring with them. I think they were supposed to tour with Sammy Hagar this year or something like that. They're a party band. They're a great rock and roll band. And we're starting with Nickelback. And Chad Kroeger's going to tell us some stories about the brothers. Of course, talking about Dimebag Darrell and Vinnie Paul from Pantera. Both of them are gone. Both of them were close friends of Chad Kroeger. They love Nickelback and they love Chad. Chad's going to tell us some stories about the brothers and how he met them. Starting now on Talk is Jericho, Chad Kroeger and Nickelback. Once again, cool to see you here, and thanks for having us do a couple shows with you.
Buddy, it's great to see you. Thanks for coming with us.
And we've bumped into each other in strange places over the years.
We have. Wait, that sounds very... That's a weird sentence right there.
Do you remember at the...
Remember that bathroom at that truck stop? That was awkward.
Called Chad for a good time, and I could barely read the number. But the one time was at Shep's table, Shep Gordon's table, at Clive Davis's Grammy party. You remember this?
That was quite the table.
You remember who was at the table?
Yeah, going around the room, and I think I brought my ex-wife with me. That's right. So I brought Avril.
Yeah.
And then next to her was Shannon and Gene Simmons, then Paul Stanley. I believe you were beside.
I was Paul's date.
You were Paul's date. And then I think it was Shep and then Alice Cooper.
Yeah.
And I pulled my phone out for a second. I'm like, this is kind of a surreal table. And as I went around, you could hear... I'm not sure if it was it Paul or no, it was either Gene or Alice that said, if you combined the touring miles at this table, it would be astronomical.
It was Alice that said that. Yeah, I'm like, it's funny too, because you stick all the rocker skids in the back of the room at the same table.
Fully. And we were we were the most well-behaved. Like,
I know. The only thing, Chad and I, or Shep and I were the only ones that were drinking. Because I think they closed the bar and we had bribed some waiter to keep bringing us the vodka and cranberry.
I was insanely hungover. Insanely hungover that night. Oh, I just remember that. Yes.
Yes.
I was like trying to hold my lunch down. I was like, my God, what did I can't remember what I did the night before, but wow.
Yeah. So that was the one time.
Yeah.
And I remember too, it was right after Glenn Frey passed away.
Yes.
And Melissa Etheridge did a Glenn Frey song, Eagle song. And everyone gives her a standing ovation after. And Gene Simmons stands up and he's got a smile on his face. Looking, and he goes, that was the shits.
That's right. He's crying. I'm trying to remember everybody, because there was some good performances there that night. There were some great performances.
I think it was Earth, Wind & Fire played, I think.
Yeah.
Nirvana with Beck. Remember that?
That's right.
something like that.
Oh my God, my I was a little cloudy that evening. Your recollection is far better, but I do have a little bit of some video proof on my phone somewhere of,
yeah,
of definitely being in attendance that night.
The great table, but then the one I wanted to talk to you about is it was the last time I saw you was at Rita's house after Vinny's funeral.
Yes,
and whenever somebody passed away, which sucks, it's always cool when you see people at the funeral that you never expected.
Yes.
I remember I went there with Charlie from Anthrax and we saw you there.
That's right.
And I was just really intrigued to get a little bit of a backstory about how did you know Vinny and how close were you guys and all that sort of thing.
Very. He was a dear, dear, dear friend.
Yeah.
I met him, I think it was, I want to say like 2003, maybe 2004, somewhere in there. And Jerry had just signed to Roadrunner Records and Jerry came out on tour with us. And Jerry was opening for us on
Jerry Cantrell.
Jerry Cantrell, gotcha. Yep. And on that tour, he said, "Well, the brothers are going to come out in Dallas." And I was like, just so naive. I'm like, "The brothers?" He's like, "Yeah, Vinny and Dimebag." And I'm like, I was just like, "Are you shitting me?" And after the show, you know, in the flesh, there's the boys on my bus. I'm like, "Is this happening right now?" I'm like, this can't be happening. And from that moment on, we were just like all fast friends. And then Bob Kid Rock invited me over to his place one time when we were doing the I think it's called the DTE,
the Detroit amphitheater,
yeah, the south of his place. He invited me up to the place and we had a little barbecue and I'm like, "Hey, I want you to listen to something." And I brought out Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting and I said, "Hey, do you want to sing the second verse of this?" And he's like, "I'm in." I'm like, "Okay, cool. That's amazing. Now I think we should find a shredder, someone to just absolutely destroy a guitar solo." And we hummed and hawed and we were tossing around a bunch of names and Dime's name didn't come up for whatever reason. And then later on that same tour, I found myself in Dallas and I get into the vehicle with him and I said, "Hey," and this was back when we had CDs. I'm like, "Hey, throw this in." And I think Rita was driving. I think Dime was in the, and I was in the back seat of the SUV. And I said, "Put this in." And it comes on and, you know, we did this really heavy version of it. And I'm like, "Dude, do you want to play the guitar solo on this?" He's like, "I would love to." So now, you know, it's, we got Kid Rock, we got Dimebag and myself doing this, just balls out version of,
Saturday night's
All Right for Fighting. And yeah, I mean, we've just, over the years, just been great, great friends.
He was this type of guy, like whenever you were in town, it could be either Dallas or Vegas, always would come to the show.
I would like to know how many concerts those two
right.
have attended. I mean, like, I don't think they miss anyone's concerts.
They anybody they
shows, just right. constantly going to shows.
Because I don't know about you, sometimes when I've been on tour for a while or on the road, you get home, you know, you say hi to your friends, "Hey, dude, I can't make it tonight or whatever." Those guys always made it.
Always?
Yeah.
When I get off tour, the last thing I want to do is go to a show.
No offense. Right?
Yeah, no. You know, it's like, God, when you've been shoveling coal 6 days a week, you don't want to shovel coal on Sunday.
That's right, yeah.
And they never missed a show. Mm. It was like unbelievable. Those guys were just dedicated to music like you wouldn't believe. And they were just so sweet, just so amazing. Yeah.
Oh, for Vegas. Yeah,
we did. That's right. We did a five-day Vegas residency. And I think he only missed one. I'm like, it's got to be getting a little boring by now, no? Like
the guys in our band were just vodka guys and the ones that drank. And so Vinny would always come and was like, "Do you have any beer?" I would always order beer. That's not even on our rider. I would order it when I knew Vinny was coming just to have it for him and his 18 guys that wanted tickets with Loge passes or whatever.
Yeah, the posse was like, it was extensive for sure. Yeah, they always wanted a bottle of Crown around when, you know, so everyone could do a black tooth.
In black tooth, yeah.
Yeah.
We do the shots in the dressing room beforehand.
Oh, yeah. I remember. During, yeah. After, after, the next day.
We did a tour with Slash once, and it was the same thing. We're like, "Yeah, Vinny Paul wants 20 tickets," and Slash is like, "I'm not having the entourage back here. Let Vinny and his girlfriend come back. Yeah. Everyone else needs to stay out there." Like, only Slash could turn down Vinny.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah, no, I mean, because he wanted to bring, because all of his buddies were all huge. I mean, how are they getting around? Because there's not a limo on the planet that could hold that many people. Like, did they have some sort of, like, did they rent a Greyhound?
Greyhound limo?
How are they getting down to the shows every night?
Because at one point, he came, we did a show in Tyler, Texas, which is just outside of Dallas. And he came and said, "I got a limo. I'll come down and catch a ride back with me." Great. So he had like this powder blue limo from like, I don't know, 1982 mm-hmm. that he had decked out with all the lights and just ear crushing music that was all Journey and ZZ Top yep. and Eagles and right.
His, did he ever give you a signed picture of oh my God, he'd go and get all these 50s pictures all the time and he would get them. I think he was just going to like Kinko's or Staples or wherever and just photocopying the hell out. And then he would sign them as though he was the person. And then he'd go get the thing framed and he would write the most random shit on it. And then he would just hand them out. And I was like, what? And there's like a second, you look at it for a second, and you're like, is this legit? And then as soon as you read it, you're like, ah, that's amazing. Like
a real picture of Elvis that he had autographed, Elvis Presley.
Oh yeah, like the most bizarre. What's that? Yeah, mine's Little Richard. That's right. I've got this weird little, he's like, to my favorite little Tutti Frutti or something like that. Like, I don't know what it is, you know, and then he signs it Little Richard and it's hilarious. And the thing is in this bizarre old school, like frame that would be in your grandmother's house. Like it's so random. I mean, he picked me up one night. I think we were in Dallas and we drove 45 minutes away. I don't have a clue where we went to. Pull up to the back, run into the back stage area of Sorry. I'd have no idea where we even went. And get on, you know, and I just in time to catch Moni, you know. And I'm like, what?
Billy Idol?
Yeah, I'm like, what are we? Where are we? And we just cruise into some, you know, venue and there's Billy Idol and he's getting off stage. Like he's hitting, he's like the Santa Claus. He was the Santa Claus. He had to hit every venue, like every live gig that was going on. He like just timing them all perfectly. Like, oh, I got to run over to this one. I got to close up everything at about 2:30. We got to head over to the after show at this one.
And then come back to his house in Vegas that had all the rooms.
Yes.
The yep. Carrot Top room was orange.
Yeah, he
the
loved
Prince
Carrot
room
Top.
Was purple.
Yeah.
And the Elvis room was green as the jungle room.
Yep.
You know, just yep. the, he would always make breakfast in the morning and all that sort of stuff. Just a great guy all across the board. Like you said, that was friend. If you were a musician and he knew you were legit, he was your friend.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. 100%. I loved those boys with all of my heart and they were so kind to me when we would be taking heat left, right, and center. You know, Vinny would just, you know, he would stick up for us. Like, you would, he's like, you ever seen a play?
Mm-hmm.
You're like, well, then why don't you just shut the fuck up?
Mm-hmm.
You know, why don't you go watch them play and see what they do and see, you know, see them doing their own thing and then come back and talk shit. And he was always sticking up for us and he didn't care, you know, and that's to me, that type of loyalty, you can't, mm-hmm. I mean, you're lucky if you find that type of loyalty once in your life in a true, true friend,
right.
You know, and he gave that to everybody.
Yeah.
It was like,
both him and
I'm trying not to, I'm no, but, my arm hair is starting to stand up a little bit and I can feel like I could easily have a really serious good cry here.
This is
talking
what I wanted,
about
I wanted like, to talk to you about it because like I said, you talk to people that know him and you get that feeling, you know, and cause you guys even actually, I don't know if you do now, but you did used to come to stage with a Pantera tune. You played Walk, I think. I remember at the beginning of, you did some Pantera.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Maybe after Dime died or
yep.
something like that. You did
yep.
a tribute to
and
him
we,
on stage.
Yeah, we had, well, we had a, we I wrote a song for him called Side of a Bullet. And we called, I mean, this was right after Dime
mm-hmm.
Passed. And called Vinny and said, hey, can you send us like a bunch of outtakes from, you know, Far Beyond Driven and Cowboys from Hell and just a bunch of him, you know, a bunch of guitar stuff that didn't get used on the album. He's like, yeah, no problem. And they went through every record and sent us tons of stuff. And we just went through it all and put it all together, put it all in the same key, and it fit. And it was amazing.
No kidding.
Yeah, and that's on a song called Side of a Bullet. And so, and we would just play his guitar solo. So we'd play the song, and then we put him up
that's
on the big screen.
That's what it was.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And so every night I was turning around and I'd look up at him and he would, you know, we had all this video footage from him doing, just being him, just being absolutely that amazing human. And, I was tough not to get choked up.
Every night
you turn around and be like, don't do it. Don't do it.
We should do something for Vinny, write a song for him and call it 1-2 Barbecue.
1-2 Barbecue. Oh, that
dude, what a 1-2 Barbecue. Get everyone to chant in the crowd.
We're going 1-2 Barbecue.
Oh, yeah, there dude, we go. It's a million seller right there. Last question
That's
for you.
That's a great idea.
We should. Imagine the guests we could get on that song.
Yeah. Man. I put Blacktooth in a song.
Did you?
Oh, yeah. I put that in a song called Bottoms Up. Yeah, I made a Blacktooth reference.
Mega Dave did that, and I was at Sweating Bullets. Smiled his Blacktooth grin.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Sweating Bullets.
Last question for you, because I know we both got a show to do. What's your favorite Pantera song?
Oof. I mean, I love, my favorite album is definitely Vulgar Display. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it's damn near cover to cover. Mouth for War is amazing.
Becoming. New Levels, I think. Becoming from Far Beyond is my favorite, yeah.
This Love. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. That record is just packed. I mean, that's almost impossible for me to just go right down to one. I mean, and now when one of those songs comes on, before we'd all, you know, everyone does the same thing. You kind of, you put your metal face on, your teeth grit. I mean, there's a small flex involves, like, you know, and you know. And everybody does the same thing, but now it's taken on a whole different thing because now you're gritting your teeth because, you know, you miss them so much. Mm-hmm. And it's taken on this whole new persona and the way it affects me, at least. And I can see the way you're nodding. I can see the look on your face. And I'm sorry that I stole Charlie from the party. You know, we're all over there at Rita's place. And when things were winding down, I'm like, Charlie, you come with me. Yeah. Let's go, buddy.
Let's get out of here.
Yeah, I had him for a while. Well, I had him for most of the day. I mean, as soon as the service had ended, I'm like, I stole him. I took him back to the hotel. We were drinking a bit and reminiscing and telling all the stories. About
good times. Vinny, dime. We love you.
Yeah, for sure.
What was Vinny's favorite Nickelback tune?
His was If Today Was Your Last Day, ironically.
Wow, apropos, right?
Yeah. And Dime's was a song called Where Do I Hide off of an album we had called Silver Side Up.
Nice,
man. And Vinny was like, I mean, it was so honest when it came out of his mouth. He's like, God, every time Dime's in the limo, he just wants to hear that Where Do I Hide song. I mean, he plays the damn thing over and over and over and over. And I don't know how you pay someone a bigger compliment than to hear that one of their heroes, you know, wants to continually play something that you've written. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just the biggest,
biggest compliment
in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, it just fills you with this feeling.
And then you could become friends with them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
you know, who saw that coming?
Thanks, dude.
Buddy, thanks for taking the time.
Appreciate that, man.
Brother.
We'll roll it right now.
Let's roll that
we'll
shit.
We'll break all the rules, man. We don't care.
Is there anything I can't say? Like,
well, you just did, so therefore you call the shots, man.
Done.
This is your show. You were just rolling around on the mat with Gracie, so you can say whatever the hell you want.
All right, man. All right.
What am I going to say? Like, no, dude, you can't swear on my show.
Mike's a cursing
machine. I do swear a little.
It's kind of a Canadian thing, I think, more than anything.
I believe you're
right. Mike and Ryan from Nickelback here, and gracious us to have us play a couple shows. And it's so funny. It's like a two-show tour. The first half was awesome.
Isn't it though?
Agreed.
You know, but the second half is always
The second half is always better.
Now we know each other. We've had lots of experience.
Now we're in the groove.
And stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So we had a day off yesterday, and you mentioned we're in Atlantic City now, but you went to New York to actually train with the Gracies?
I trained at Henzo Gracie's Academy with him. And, you know, you've done plenty of training yourself. And I just told these guys the amazing moment that you get on the mat with somebody who is the top of their game. Mm-hmm. And you are at the bottom of said
the game.
Right. You know, I get on the mat, get all suited up, and I get on the mat with Henzo, and we sit down, and he says, okay, what would you like to learn? I'm just like, you kidding, right? Like, this is going to be only learning. And to be honest, within half an hour, my brain was so full, we just had to drill the stuff that he taught me and stop, because I just couldn't take, you know what happens? Like, there's only so much you can really translate into.
Well, totally. So obviously you train like this often?
I try to train as much as I can, yeah.
So how do you get in touch with Gracie and say, hey, I'm Mike from Nickelback, I'm in town, or do you know this guy, or is it...
I knew him from before. Mm-hmm. We have a few mutual friends, and I train with his family. Train with the Machado family in Los Angeles, and they're the cousins of the Gracies.
Oh, okay.
So I know them that way, but I met Henzo Abu Dhabi, I think it was. Because we had a security guy who was a friend of his.
I just love it. Like, the best part of all is, like, was it Abu Dhabi that we...
I know, he's going through his Rolodex of places. I thought he was going, like, time frame, but you're actually talking about a place.
Yeah. A time frame, I have no idea.
Yeah.
But the place, I think it was Abu Dhabi, but it might have been somewhere else.
But see, this is a cool thing I like about guys like us that have been traveling. Most people be like, Abu Dhabi, where's that? And I'm like, oh, yeah, I know Abu Dhabi. Was it the Porsche Museum or the Lamborghini Museum there or something like that? Like, you guys have traveled... quite a bit worldwide over the last 15 years.
Yeah.
So even Abu Dhabi wants the rock and roll of Nickelback there.
Oh yeah, we apparently played the F1 a little while ago, and by the Ferrari Museum,
yes,
we played that F1 race. That was incredible.
Well, man, you live the traveling life, you know.
Yeah.
You know,
well, yeah, but that's the thing, and we just take it for granted because people think that the shows are always fun, but it's the travel part that's what we get paid for. That's the hard part.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
absolutely.
It's cool to see these the limited glimpses of these cultures that we get. You know, we typically get to see only the good parts.
Yeah,
which is nice. I appreciate that. Get, you know, all the horrible parts of these places get combed out, and we just see the good parts.
See the good parts. So when we did Abu Dhabi, a WWE show, the girls were still wearing the burqas, you know, and that sort of thing. Yeah. So it's so funny to see them. I remember I went to the ring with this guy called R-Truth. He's like a rap guy. He goes like, what's up? And people put their hands in the air, and you see the girls with the burqas with their eyes showing, like raising the roof. And it's just like the culture shock of that.
You know what? You know, the debate of that aside, which, I mean, I think it's kind of, it's been laid out lately, but
sure.
I always found that was the cool part of actually going over there and seeing people from different cultures actually,
like having fun,
getting into whatever.
You know what?
There's another
part to this that I personally experienced when I was over there. Was I had heard the stories about the, you know, women aren't allowed to drive and they got to be fully covered in the burqas and shit like that. And then I went to what's that mall called? That great big mall in Dubai.
In Dubai?
I can't remember.
That's right next to the Burj.
Dubai
Khalifa.
Mall, maybe?
Yeah, we'll call it the Dubai Mall.
But I went there and I was expecting to see, you know, this. And at the mall, I was walking down the one of the corridors in the mall, and I saw a woman wearing a bikini in the mall. And I was that isn't exactly a burqa on that one. This hardly anything.
Sure, wasn't like a La Senza ad or something like that?
It was a person, legit human.
Watching. Because we did Saudi Arabia, and that's even worse than Dubai, because you can't drink in Saudi Arabia, and women aren't allowed at the shows. But I saw a couple women that were kind of like our tour group, like the promoters or whatever, very beautiful faces with like heavy makeup, like models.
Yeah.
And I said, well, how come you guys can have this makeup and other girls can't show their faces? It was something to do with like some kind of a different religion, something. Mm-hmm. Maybe this religion in Dubai allows you to wear a bikini.
I don't
know. Who knows, right?
Maybe they're just, I think things are just opening up, man.
So you're talking about going to Abu Dhabi. What are some of the other countries that you've been to that are kind of off the beaten path?
Oh, I'm maybe not totally off the
beaten path. Lithuania is pretty awesome.
That's becoming not so off the beaten path anymore. Right? Like, I know what you're saying, totally. I mean,
like different countries.
We did like Singapore for the first time, which is really, really great.
Russia, Russia, of course.
Russia gigs, obviously.
Russia's a huge rock.
Oh, man.
Oh, yeah.
Like 3 days grace did like a 3 week tour of Russia.
I'm
where are you going in Russia for 3 weeks?
Yeah.
Turns out there's a lot to it.
Yeah.
There's Rock a lot
isn't
to
dead
it.
In
Russia, and they'll turn out in droves for you. They love it, man.
Yeah. We did Lithuania, but Estonia was our first time. Yeah. It's not like off the beaten path so much, like I said, but it's like for us.
Countries that you wouldn't expect.
Yeah. And well, we had never been there before. We've done, you know, Helsinki numerous times. And
Finland.
It's right across the water from
But think about where we come
fantastic.
From.
Like in
think about.
Italian.
Yeah, think about where we come from and then frame that. Like,
oh no,
where
absolutely.
We come from, and it's like, oh yeah, well, Helsinki, pff, you know, of course. Yeah,
if you're talking to Bruce Dickinson, he's like, we've done that 10,000 times.
Right.
I always say
Drumheller, because that's what I was always told, but it's not quite Drumheller where you guys are from.
It's very close. I actually grew up
to the east.
Yeah, our hometown is about 40 minutes kind of east.
What's your hometown called?
Hannah.
Okay,
Hannah.
So
Alberta.
I trained, I grew up in Winnipeg, but I trained for wrestling in Calgary. Mm-hmm. So my first kind of year of shows are the little independent ones. So I was doing the Drumhellers and the Rimby and the
Brooks.
My first match was in Pinoca.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like total, like Alberta small towns. Yeah. But once again,
rodeo towns, man.
What was that?
Rodeo towns.
Rodeo towns, exactly. Yeah. Grand Prairie and these type of places. How would you guys come from Hannah and start this band to end up playing in freaking Abu Dhabi and Helsinki?
It's crazy.
Right? Like, it's give us a little bit of that background.
It still blows me away that I'm even going to New York.
Because quickly, just, you know, too, Slash, whenever he plays, because you guys, I'm sure you've played, it's with Slash or no Slash, he's a huge Dinosaur fanatic. Mm-hmm. So whenever Guns N' Roses or Slash and the Conspirators play Edmonton or Calgary, he goes to Drumheller to go to the museums there because this is like
that
dinosaur. The
paleontology museum is still fantastic.
It's tons crazy. Of fossils found in this area, right?
Yeah. I met these guys in like when I was in grade eight in Hannah's when I moved. I used to live in Brooks.
Brother, that's very Canadian. Grade eight here. Yeah, grade eight. It's eighth grade. I still don't know what a freshman, senior.
I'm still struggling with that.
Started. I just had that conversation, but I actually grew up.
It's a real thing.
It totally is. I actually grew up in the valley. There's a small, tiny town called Dorothy. If you ever see Tom Cochran's video, Life is a Highway, he's up on the summer fallow fields and down by this church with these two weird sisters he puts together for imagery and whatnot. But yeah, that's Dorothy.
No shit. I didn't know that.
My uncle's land, actually. Funny enough, I heard that like through the grapevine. He's like, oh yeah, well,
that's interesting. That's crazy.
But we were like cruising up the hills as kids, like getting fossils and petrified wood. It's an amazing place to,
and that's just
to let run wild there. It's
like your backyard where you grew up, right?
Totally. And I took my kids back there 2 years ago, and I've never heard so much complaining in my life. I'm like, they'll drop us off here, we'll walk down the coulee in the valley down, and it'll spit us out of my grandmother's house, and they're just like, I hate this. There's fire ants on my leg. There's cactus. And they're just complaining. I'm like,
we were just in the Okanagan. My cousin got married in Penticton. Nice. And my grandparents lived in Kelowna, right? Mm-hmm. So fruit stands, my grandma worked at a fruit stand. Right? It's like the best place. I took my kids to the roadside fruit stand. Like, Dad, why are we going? This is great. It's a fruit stand. There's fruit and there's jelly and you get a donut.
Is there Wi-Fi?
And they're just like, yeah, exactly. They're like, and they finally found some cool stuff. I'm like, you guys, like, things have changed. Like looking for fossils and going to a fruit stand don't fly for kids anymore.
Yeah. I don't know. You tried to like expose a bit of it. I went home for 2 days as well, this last kind of little break here, and I was saying the same thing. I'm like, how can we have no Okanagan fruit here? I mean, this is the season. We've got nothing?
Yeah.
Like, it only happens once a year. What's going on?
Right.
I know. My kids care
less. Now, the kids are different now, though, right? Yeah. So how did you guys start this band, though, in Hannah, to end up, you know, like we said, becoming a worldwide, one of the biggest bands in the world?
Well, it kind of started in Vancouver.
Really. Gotcha.
I mean, we come from Hannah, the band.
Yeah.
Started in Vancouver, but we get pretty much all of Alberta and British Columbia claims us as home. So that's we're cool with that.
It's complicated.
It is.
Now we our music. You know, everybody starts music somewhere when you're, you know, hopefully when you're a kid. I don't know, whenever you like. But we were like 14 when we kind of started, and then Mike and I kind of played in various versions of some kind of band,
like garage bands and stuff.
Garage bands. Yeah. Oh, totally. Like no one wants to hear us when you're starting to play music.
They didn't want to hear us in the garage.
You sound okay. You're like, thank God they didn't have cell phones back then.
Right. You guys be posting on YouTube channel. Yeah.
Oh my God, it would be a disaster. But so we played a bit when we were younger, and we did a little cover band stint for about 9 months, and that's when Chad. Actually came into the band.
Because Chad's your brother.
Yeah.
Yes.
Older brother, younger brother.
Younger.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So we had
can't tell by
singer.
Looking, can you?
Oh, I can. We had a different singer and a different drummer. And then Chad came in to play lead guitar. And then we did this for about 9 months and just were pretty much flat broke. It was fun to cut your teeth out there and kind of get used to being you on stage. It's easy to play like one show and try to find yourself and find your stage presence. But I mean, as you know, it's like doing in the entertainment industry, you know, over and over repetition, you kind of find yourself and where you feel comfortable sitting. So that was something I think that helped us a bit. We didn't realize it, but we just stopped and we just went, you know, this is just going nowhere.
What was the name of your band?
Music. At the moment, our childhood band before that was called Village Idiot. And then we went out
to get
real work. And the booking agent said, no, you can't have that name. You got a choice. You pick something else. Like, I think they settled on, we were taking some advice, Point of View at one point.
That
and
was
I
the more commercial, commercial friendly
I'm like,
thing the agent wanted
pick
us to use.
A more forgettable what name? Because I don't remember that. So we told them to piss off and we changed it back to Village Idiot, singular. We were the singular idiot.
We four comprised one idiot. Yeah, that's how stupid we were.
25% each idiot.
So then we stopped, and then we all went back to our jobs. And Mike went to Vancouver to do a different gig with another band, and then it was Chad in the summertime of '95 that just said he had some songs, wouldn't mind recording it. We knew somebody, a friend of a friend, had a studio or had access to a studio in Vancouver. It literally you just stumble into this kind of shit,
right?
Like, so we went out in the summer and we recorded Hesher, our first EP. In a day and a half.
Explain everybody what a Hesher is.
Hesher, well, I'll tell you what, there's two versions of Hesh's, yeah, I guess.
I didn't know it. I didn't know what it, what the word even, I didn't know it was even a word.
No, because
I have a version.
What's your version?
Like a headbanger. Yes. Like a Hesher. Like, found that out. Like a rocker.
We found that out much later.
Yeah. It was literally just, yeah, sure.
I had a friend of mine, he came out from Alberta to my place in Vancouver. And I remember, you know, we were trying to think of a name for the thing. And I remember this friend of mine, I don't remember what we were doing all day, but we were tired out. And I am sleeping in my room because, like, it was not Lux. it was pretty bad. But I remember him saying, I said something like, okay, good night, see you tomorrow. And he said something like, Hesher. And I was like, oh, Hesher. Oh, that's
he just invented a word.
And I was like, yeah, that doesn't mean anything, does it? Let's use that. And then we found out it meant something.
Hesher's a headbanger, yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's a California term.
I believe it is.
Yeah. And I've heard it since then. It's like, now I kind of get it. I'm like, well, whatever connotation floats your boat, I suppose. But
So you did the Hesher EP?
Yeah, so we did that. And just, I'll try to wrap it up, but it's like the...
No, I want our whole career.
You want me to just run
the
rag out here?
Today. Yeah, bring the rag to today.
No.
I'm going to order lunch.
But I'm trying to clarify what he means by, you know, we've been claimed by like Alberta, BC.
Right, sure.
In a sense, because, you know, we had a lot of following. And our friends are like crucial in this, in our career, and pivotal, I think, just because of the support we had in Alberta.
Mm.
But then that was just getting up to that point. The recording of the demo in a day and a half. We drove out, recorded it, drove home.
Oh, to Vancouver.
Yeah, and it's like back. It's like 12 hours from where we live. So 12 hours there, 12 hours back.
Just a little drive
over a weekend. So we recorded it over kind of like a few days, and then that was it. It was like that was for fun. That wasn't like, okay, so there's the next thing we're gonna do, and then we're gonna give it to managers. And we're gonna you know, pitch it around. We just weren't there.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't think of it. We wanted to go. You know, do you want to see what a studio's like? Yeah, let's check it out. And then we did that, and it was great. And that was it. And so I went back, and I was going to get a job, I think, checking wells, oil wells, you know, good old Alberta.
Good Alberta job.
That's
just
what you do.
Head up to the Mac.
Yeah. Or wherever you can go.
Hard exactly, in the right? Mac. Yes.
So and then Mike had a copy of the album, obviously, and he was sleeping in
Oh, in that was, yeah, place, that was when was I didn't even
like
have
a dealer's den of some sort.
Yeah, I was sleeping
in. And it was the typical, like, warehouse with graffiti and crap everywhere, and it was like
cat piss rugs on the walls to make it quieter and
beautiful.
Yeah, right. Yeah, but
the real deal.
Yeah.
So some managers heard it and they said, I think get it on the radio, which they did. And then they said, hey, they want you to come play a gig. And we're like, wow, okay. And then we're like, well, what's your band's name? We're like, I have no idea.
We didn't have a band, we weren't anything.
Mm. And so that's when we're like, well, it's this thing, it might, we can get a gig out there. And it was at a place called the Town Pump in Gastown, Vancouver.
Yeah, I know that place.
Which was like the place to play.
It was a hip place to play.
Oh, yeah. It was the place to play in town. It was like, that's where you wanted to get to. And we're like, our first gigs there. Mm. Holy shit. We were opening for a band called Rust that was signed to Warner or...
Was Capitol that the first time at the Pump, or was it the Medicine Ball was the first time?
No, that was the second time.
The Rust.
Medicine Ball was the second time.
And just for people that don't understand, this is a huge gig to have for your 100th gig, and this is your very first gig.
It's just a reputable place to play.
It's like playing the Whiskey or something, exactly, or whatever,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. It's not a big place, but it's a reputable place. And so we came out in January 96, and he came up with the name, and we just moved forward.
The name Nickelback?
Yes.
Where did you get the name from?
Say it, Mike.
It's okay. It doesn't bother me. It might bother some people to do it over and over. It doesn't bug me.
I'm just curious.
No, it's okay. I worked at a coffee shop.
Oh,
and
okay.
I was making change. Seriously, I had to give people 5 cents back all the time. And I was saying, here's your nickel back. And I said it so many times that I was like, wait a minute, that kind of...
It works, right?
I'm saying it so much because it kind of like rolls off the... Yeah. You know, like it sort of sounds kind of interesting.
And being like dum-dums from Canada that aren't into football and stuff, I didn't even know it was a position.
Yeah, again,
I didn't either.
Again, it's a thing. It's a thing we thought we made up, but we didn't.
Yeah, so it's just like Hesher. So then you're two for two.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Dating ourselves with the arrival of the internet, right. And you start searching. Oh, I wonder if anybody's talking about the band Nickelback. What's all this football shit going on here?
Yeah,
what's going on?
We got to compete with this. And then there was Nickelbag. There was also a band called Nickelbag at the time. Yeah. We're like, what?
They're from like Portland or something.
Yeah, so it was a little confusing, but so that was the impetus essentially. So.
And that's how it started. Yeah. And then, to like we said, to get to this level where there's a few bands in the world that have had, you know, is it 50 million records sold and all this sort of thing?
I mean, that
to me just blows my mind when you hear that sort of a stat as well. You know, what was the opening breakthrough that got you guys? Was it How You Remind Me?
For sure, How You Remind Me, yes.
How You Remind Me.
Did you have, because every band has either great management or the record company support. What was it for you guys? Who was like your real champion to get to that point?
Well, you can say me if you want, Mike.
Okay, it's Ryan.
Ryan, it's pretty much all due to Ryan. Because I don't have a really effective answer other than that. I mean, it was very much a... No, but when you're talking about isolating sort of a person or a group of people that's responsible for this, I think it was really a team effort between management, us, of course, a label, of course, our booking agents, like all these people. We had an army of people that would kill for us. We signed to a metal label, Roadrunner Records, which was kind of a nutty move.
Yeah. That's interesting. How did Roadrunner have taken you? Because you said that's King Diamond and Annihilator and Slipknot, Fear Factory,
Sepultura. I this occurred to me not that long ago, which is weird because it's been a long time. We haven't even been on the label for a long time. I was a fan of the label.
Yeah.
I used to buy records. Like, I would buy albums because they were Roadrunner
Just because
records.
Of Roadrunner
records. I remember pretty that. Common, like Metal Blade and stuff. Yeah,
I was like there with Metal Blade. If it came out on Metal Blade, I would buy it.
That's kind of it, right? It's like, they like it. It's got to be good.
Yeah, it's got to be good.
That was Roadrunner. It really was.
Completely.
It was like that for me.
So, and the same, in the same kind of sentence, like, we're like, well, why do they want us? We're nothing like these acts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when we had the meeting, it was literally, I guess, I don't know if you would call it a dichotomy of going to RCA Records. And then going to Roadrunner Records, one floor, gritty. It was really, they were like digging for what they, what they believed.
They had to fight for everything.
Was it an American label? They're in New York. Yeah. Well, they're actually
they were in Holland at the
based
time.
The Netherlands, there. Yeah.
But the New York office was,
the main brain.
Because the United States is the number one market for music in the world.
Right.
Obviously, it's going to carry a lot of
weight. Want some presence there.
Yeah, for sure.
But they were shifting gears. And we didn't realize at the time that they were talking to a radio guy that was... We knew that some of our songs had some... we were rock, but rock was kind of just starting to bubble right there and come around. Because previously, we couldn't get anybody to pay attention to us because it was... things are very cyclical and are looking for the next... They chase the next... fascinating
trend.
I think it was a female artist at the time, female solo artist at the time.
What year was this at?
Paula Cole and
like mid-90s.
The
end of the 90s. 98.
Okay, gotcha.
98. No, it was 99, I think.
Yeah, 98
I think recorded 99.
Yeah, because that'd be more of also too like the new metal of Korn and that sort of stuff.
Yes, that was definitely coming up as well. It wasn't, I don't know if it in Canada, I remember
it,
you
it
had
wasn't,
stuff
it,
like
wasn't
that. It wasn't,
nothing was, because those people chase commercial trends, right?
Yeah,
these labels. So, that stuff wasn't a commercial trend at all
at the time.
That time, it was Sarah McLachlan,
it
was Paula Cole,
and it was great. That's
Shania
great.
Twain. But if you weren't a female singer songwriter, I remember at a point somebody said,
"Why not?"
If you're not a singer, like a female singer songwriter, right now we're not writing.
So ridiculous, right?
But that's just what people were looking for. That's what they were after.
Well, that's what kills trends. If you look at, if you liked, if you want to call hair metal or whatever it was, kind of bled that out, and then the thrash metal thing, and then. Yeah. Grunge and then new metal, they throw so much of it at you. Only the best bands survive. And there's too many pretenders, which is what kills the scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
because the
and fatigue,
the industry at large doesn't know how to make hits. It just knows how to chase hits.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
What
radio station was it we talked to? Z100 in New York or K-Rock in LA? They said, we don't make hits. We play hits.
Yeah, the K-Rex
was
like that.
Shit,
thanks.
You're not going to play our song, are you? And they're like, well, not till it's a hit.
Well, we sure weren't the cool kids at that time, but
have we ever been the cool kids? Let's get real.
But that was the reason, like going back to what you said, you like Metal Blade albums, stuff like that. I mean, I hadn't really been following the acts from Roadrunner at that point, but when you went there and you saw how much they believed, like the people working for them were working to make everything work because they loved it. You could feel it, like totally. And so for us, it was a no-brainer as a choice. Like you could get a major label deal or you can get a great indie label deal. And these guys were just like putting everything behind it. And so I think that was like, some bands hate their labels. They did a great job for us. There were times of headbutting for sure. Absolutely.
Yeah, there always will be.
But, and we heard about this just lately, but we heard there was a, Case Vessels, the guy that owned the label, when a guy owned the label, about the memo he put out when we put the state out, went touring, sold, 300,000 albums. So we didn't like boom like they wanted and, burned a lot of their cash. And most,
we spent a lot
most
of
majors
money.
Would go snip and just cut you loose. And they were just like, guys, we got to get this money back somehow, man. Like, I don't know, you know, it's like, so we're going to put you out there. You're going to do it again. We're going to do it again. We're like, well, I'm good with that. And that was Silver Side Up. And when How You Remind Me came out and was released, he put out this, apparently this inter-office memo just saying, I didn't even heard of until 2 years ago. Yeah. And he was just like, I can't quote verbatim what he said, but he said
it's probably in Dutch, so don't worry about it.
Yeah, it's probably in Dutch. Yeah, but it was completely like just saying, I believe in this song, I believe in this hit, I believe, and I need to see you guys giving it 110% everywhere here. I won't settle for people, you know, resting on their heels for this thing, and just big motivating. I need you to do this. This one is going to work, and we believed in our stuff too. But it was nice. It's nice to hear when you have somebody that you're working with. Kind of like coming from the top like that. I don't think it was lip service. I think it was like, I don't know.
But he was right. It wasn't like being a normal label.
Nice. It's nice when you're right. For sure, right?
But you hear these, you know, or you work with these people, these labels, and you realize at the time, and I think it's still the case, there's a big difference between an indie and a major. Because a major just has this titanic wallet that they can just throw at their problems, right? They can solve their problems with money. The indies, especially the Roadrunner people, remember, these people are trying to get people to buy Fear Factory records, right?
Right.
So nothing's coming easy. They fight for everything. Like, Fear Factory is a deadly band. I love them. I'm a huge fan of the work that they did. Deadly. Then. I love them. Deadly. Eh? They're so deadly good. Daddy. I just love them. But to make that a commercial success of any kind is going to be a war.
Their appeal only goes to a certain level.
Yeah, not commercially, it doesn't appeal to a wide enough base of people. So you sell your records one at a time and you get out there and you fight. And we watched them do that, where the other labels were, I remember talking about it when we were talking about what label to talk to. And I remember somebody, I don't know if it was one of our management or something like that, said, well, if you're on a major label, you got 6 weeks. You make a record, you spend all the promo money, you do all the lead up, you do all the prep time, they release it in 6 weeks. If it hasn't popped yet, you're done. They're gonna drop you. They're gonna move on.
Happen. It's funny, I watched that. I'll leave the band unnamed, mind you, but a band I really liked from Canada got picked up in the States. They got 6 weeks and they were like super popular in Canada and they would have been great, but they 6 weeks and they got cut loose.
There's so many bands like that. Like, even like if you go back, like one of my favorite bands from like the early 80s is Streetheart.
Mm-hmm.
They've
got
probably 20 amazing songs.
Yeah.
Better than Loverboy. Yep. But Loverboy made it and Streetheart didn't.
Yep.
Why is that? Record company, whatever, that happens. And it's a shame when you see it.
Well, you can talk about the Hip too.
That's the biggest one of all.
I mean, like, they're in the hearts of every Canadian. Like, they're going to go down in history as like one of the best.
Maybe the biggest Canadian band in Canada.
Absolutely.
Ever. Like blows Rush away, right?
For me, one of the best bands ever, but they'll be in Canada. They got kind of stuck with Canada for whatever reason.
We had a whole podcast about that, so people listening know about the Hip. What is your theory about why the Hip never made it further?
Well, and I shouldn't say that because they've played lots of places.
They're a stadium band in Canada.
You know, honestly, I think. Okay, you go ahead. Okay, I'll go ahead.
I know what you're going to say, and it's like, but what I'm going to
then you can say what I'm going to say too.
No, I'm going to say
then
something.
Then I'm going to say what you both said.
Yeah, let's all say it together, guys.
Go.
No, honestly. I've heard theories. Everybody's heard theories, and I'm sure they're sick and tired of hearing that kind of shit.
It's the Illuminati, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe, right?
I knew it.
Opportunity and timing. I think we, in respect to us, we were so lucky with timing with the type of music. People were ready for it. The single worked at the time. It just happened. Sometimes you just don't get that right opportunity or that right spot or that right moment. I'm such a believer in that, and you need to be in the game for that to happen. Number one, so everybody's out there trying and stuff like that. But I think timing is so crucial in this because, like you say, everybody says there's so many great bands. Why didn't these guys make? Why they're great bands? I don't know. Timing and matching up something with an emotional connection to something. I don't know, but I think timing and opportunity is everything. Huge.
So let's get back to what I was going to say.
Let's do this, Mike.
What was I going to say? Well, you said you knew what I was going to say. What was I going to say?
Well, I'll tell you later.
Tell me after I say it.
I'm right. You're right.
Yeah. I just wanted to see because you probably can finish. You see, we know each other so well. Yeah. We finish each other's
sandwiches.
Yeah.
Boom, boom, boom.
Yep. You know, I think your suspicion is this, and it's right.
And I don't think it's right, though, but go on.
Okay. I think that the reason that they are such a great Canadian band is because they are so Canadian. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that is the Achilles heel. I think their biggest hit song outside of Canada was New Orleans Is Sinking.
Mm-hmm.
Because they weren't singing about Timmins, Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's right,
yeah.
But I think it's the fact.
I agree with you on that. I think it was overtly Canadian. I think the pivotal moment for them was when they played SNL, when Absolutely. Dan Aykroyd got them on, mm-hmm. and they went out with Grace 2, which is a grower, not a shower.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
probably my favorite hip song.
It's one of my favorite hip
but
songs.
I didn't like it at first. I'm like, why would they play this? Why wouldn't they do 50 Mission Cap or yeah. New Orleans Is Sinking
yeah.
or, you know, a Blow It High Door yeah. or Little Bones, something that had yeah. some drive to it.
But they yeah. did Nautical Disaster, and I love that one.
I know, but like once again,
I know what you're saying.
It's a very Canadian style sure. thing. And also too, had a Springsteen or a Pearl Jam, who loved the hip from what I hear, taking them with them on tour, maybe it would have been a difference. But they never had a real champion for them in the States that went, who cares if they're Canadian? We're going to take them out and we want you to hear what
they're awesome.
Opportunity yeah. and
timing. They're just
that's
awesome.
Kind of what I'm
exactly.
Yeah, so, I understand.
I kind of right. disagree with the timing. I don't, not to, you know,
you're wrong.
Not to lock
it's fine.
Horns
you can
with
do
you,
it, but you're wrong.
But timing
sandwiches.
Sandwiches. Right. Thank you.
But the timing argument doesn't really make sense because what's their career? Like 100 years? They went over every trend there is.
Yeah.
You know, so the timing passed them by several times.
But just because you're in a genre doesn't, in a similar genre for, it's that's kind of hot right now, and that doesn't mean necessarily what timing necessarily means. Maybe you get the right gig at the right moment and somebody sees you, maybe Pearl Jam's there, and it's like you can call it the opportunity timing, same thing, but maybe somebody's there to give them,
I know what you're
right?
saying,
you know what I'm saying?
Now, yeah. mm-hmm.
That's
I kind of
what I mean. I'm not
yeah.
talking about era.
Okay.
Right?
Time
okay.
Right. But you mentioned around this time frame when this music was coming back in, you talk about how you remind me how it broke through. Because, yeah. like I said, I remember, as we talked about it, we were at the NHL Awards in 2002 or something.
Oh,
and you guys played that tune. It was when it was at its peak. Yeah. And it was kind of when guitar-driven rock and roll with solos, guitar solos are allowed yeah. to be played again. And imagine. You guys were right there at that point in time. Once again, there's your timing
sure.
coming out with a great tune and people were kind of open and ready for it because it was a real huge radio hit pretty much out of the gate from what I remember.
It was
the right song at the right time.
It's yeah. crazy. That's, it was that's really crazy. Was. Like yeah. And again, I don't even, like, I mean, there's lots of great songs out there and stuff and I don't even know why. I don't like to ask necessarily so much why, because it worked out, it was great, but yeah, it just it popped, it went everywhere for us, and that just opened all the doors, like globally. And that's when we started to really go to work, and we really really focused on, you know, putting everything we made right back into the show. Mm-hmm. Right back into the show, because it was always about having people walk away, you know, saying I like the CD, I think I like them better live.
Because this is something for people that don't know Nickelback, don't know how big your show is and how much pyro and how heavy it is, and there's that whole side of that people that aren't Nickelback fans don't know about, like you said.
Well, and I can tell you why. It's interesting. Someone mentioned that the other day. I'm trying to think of who it was. It was our Steve Call, our agent. He said,
okay,
he played. He said, I forgot. I deliberately didn't play certain songs for my daughter, he said, because of song content. So she thought we were this pop band.
Mm.
And so she's, you didn't tell me they did this and this and this. And it's like, your radio friendly songs get picked first when you're on a label. I get it. And we did have rock songs out there that got, I guess, were radio friendly and got picked up by certain, you know, active modern rock radio stations. But we like the lighter stuff. We like the heavier stuff too. And that stuff didn't always get picked up in that sense too. So we have this kind of spectrum of music. I mean, everybody's got their spectrum music, but we like the real melodic stuff. And I like the real heavy stuff.
I have fun with the hater sphere. Really.
Well, let's talk about this because you came into the dressing room to talk about it. Yeah, we have a lot of similarities in that.
Yeah. Because
we have it too with our band.
People talk
because
mad
of
shit.
Me.
Yeah, people talk right. mad shit.
Right.
The thing that I always found to be just hilarious about the hater sphere of us in particular was people saying, oh, all their music sounds the same. It's all the same radio shit. You just hear everything on the radio and it's all the same. Well, if it's shit on the radio, what are you doing listening to the radio? If you don't listen to the radio, you wouldn't hear it. So what you're saying is you're intentionally listening to music you don't like.
Yeah.
What the f*** is wrong with you? Like, what, you know what I mean? Like, how can this this possibly compute in a logical world? If a person says, oh, it's all that same shit that I hear on the radio. It's like, well, what, that's radio music that you're listening to
Well, yeah, but then once again, I mean, that'd be like, I don't know, take it extreme. Oh, More Than Words, that's a shit radio song. Okay, great. But they have 1,000 great funk metal, great tunes. Totally. Or like, you know, yelling at Metallica because of Enter Sandman. Okay, well, then go listen to Four Horsemen and go listen to Spit Out the Bone from the new record. It's as thrashy as it gets.
Yeah.
There's always that element of fans. Like I always say, wrestling fans, Jericho fans, Kiss fans, Star Wars fans, they hate everything. But they still listen to it and still
of course they do.
Continue to buy
I think,
it.
And, I think there's more of those shit talkers in the audience every night than not.
Really? Yeah.
I believe they buy tickets.
Even at your show. Right. At your shows. Yes. Yeah. And because it's funny. Cause
is funny.
Well, I was going to say, they parrot, you know, people parrot a lot of things, right? You know,
bingo. Obviously,
and the internet.
What's that called? Positive confirmation bias? Positive confirmation bias.
I haven't heard that one before.
Yeah.
They love confirmation bias.
Everybody positive confirmation bias.
It's the thing that in a room full of people, when somebody says something that's accepted in the Overton window and all the heads nod, positive confirmation bias, because they're saying something that they already feel like everybody's going to agree with as soon as they say it.
Just to get the approval of the room.
That's why they're saying it.
Gotcha.
They're not saying it because it's their opinion. They're saying it because they want people to accept them.
Right.
Well, I mean, that's human nature. I kind of get
holy
that.
Shit. I am sitting on a black leather couch.
Yeah, right. And he's like, "What a breakthrough, Mike! Oh my god!" But no, like you were saying as well. Everybody lives in their own microcosm,
sure.
Right? It's always worse for you, it seems. But it's like everybody gets their degree of hate and degree of detractors and vitriol on the internet. So it's like you understand it more where you're in the eye of the hurricane, I think,
right.
Of your own hurricane. And maybe it's the only one that's happening to, right? Sometimes.
I know what happened with us for years because Fozzy exists and Jericho's in the band and Jericho's also a wrestler. So automatically, it's just a wrestler thing. And we had to work twice as hard to get people's respect just because of me. That's it. But once we got it, then people are like, oh, wow, this is really cool. We like it. Yeah. Or listen, if you don't like it, that's fine. But at least listen to it. Don't just say, I don't like it.
I don't know anything about your wrestling career. I know you're the guy from Fozzy, man.
But there you go. And there's a lot of people that are that now,
too. Crush. Your band's heavy.
Thanks, dude. And we were laughing, too. Like, when you were reading some of our comments.
Uh-huh.
And one guy was like, I love Fozzy, but you're playing with Nickelback. I'm never liking Fozzy again. You guys, how stupid are you? Like Nickelback, wow. Let's not like Nickelback with 10,000 screaming fans a night, 50 million records sold. It's like, can I be in a band that sucks that bad too,
sounds
please?
Sounds like a terrible experience.
You know?
I didn't realize this. Like, I mean, we would be like so polarizing. Like, that's the one thing that's kind of shocking to me. It's like,
So what caused the polarization, though?
I don't know. It's like,
what is it, right?
There's theories and whatnot I've read, which I don't know. There's a lot of theories. There's a lot of theories on the internet. I wasn't like really hyper aware of any sense in the 70s when the disco like polarization was really going on. That was the first time I'd heard of after that was that, you know, people just were like, just like crazy about disco hate at that point. People getting mad about something, about some kind of music kind of thing. And I'm just like,
just don't listen.
Right. Don't listen
Turn
to
the
it.
Radio
like,
off if you
I mean,
don't like
that,
it.
And that's when I was a younger age. Like, you listen to what you like and you listen, you go with what you like. And I don't get too wound up about it. So when that happens, I try to get inside their heads as to why the people get so wound up about it. Just like there's a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you get wound up about this thing?
But people get wound up about stuff that doesn't matter.
People like to commiserate. They do. They love to just talk about what they, you know, what itches their ass, so to speak.
Yeah.
And oh, you too? Yeah. Da, 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 but price of gas sucks these days, right? Yeah, it's just getting bit over this.
But I,
like,
I
you know,
think
I get it.
I think that's very rock and roll. I never wanted to be in a band or anything that I've done where people go, that's not bad. I want people to go, it fucking rules, or I fucking hate it. Because when I grew up, it was different back in then. I'm a couple years older than you guys, but when Metallica first came out, people hated Metallica.
Yeah.
And I was like, I love Metallica.
Yeah.
I remember getting in fights over Metallica or getting in fights over Kiss or, you know, any of these bands. It's like, That's you're standing up for your band.
And
if you don't like it, I love this band even more.
Yeah.
I think that's kind of a cool thing to have.
It's definitely rock and roll attitude, that's for damn sure. I mean,
right.
It was more targeted punk.
Well, the you
punk
know
was like everything.
Yeah.
So as a small aside here, talking about people that have, you know, reined in their fair share of hate, one of the guys I met yesterday on the mat at Henzo's place is a dude named Harley Flanagan. You know who that is?
Cro-Mags.
That guy is the definition of not giving a f-
right.
Because you look at their band, the music they played, the crap, those are riots. Their audiences are riots. Those are not safe places.
Mm-hmm.
And they never have been. They're still going. And you know, and I have my picture taken with him on the mat, right?
So he's doing jiu-jitsu training.
He's a black
as well.
Belt, man. He's a slayer. He's great. That guy is an assassin.
That guy was punk in like 1985.
Dude.
The Cro-Mags.
Way ahead of their time.
Yeah.
Way ahead of their time. They invented
Hetfield used to wear a Cro-Mag shirt like in 1985.
Yes, yes.
And Charlie and Scott, the Anthrax too.
Yes, man. Those guys were leaders before people could even understand what they were doing.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had my picture taken with him and he goes, yeah, I'm going to post this on my Instagram. I was like, I said the same thing I said to you.
Look
I was
out.
Like, hang on for the shitstorm, man. They're going to talk some mad shit about you. We get a lot of hate. And he goes, you think you get some hate, brother? He goes, you should see, I've been eating it for decades.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, they're not going to give me anything I've never had before.
Right,
goes, and what was funny was he told me he didn't get any. He goes. I think it's because they think we're going to choke them all out. I was like, I think they're right.
If you come to one of your shows, like I said, like I remember seeing, I don't remember when it was. Maybe it was after Dime passed away, or maybe it was just in your set. You guys were covering a Pantera tune, or at least playing Pantera, or maybe you had Pantera to lead you into the show.
We usually went up to walk.
Yeah.
To walk, then, right.
But we also, you know, I think Chad would play some Cowboys.
But did you, is it Sad But True that you do? There's something you do.
We did Sad But True on a European tour.
Yeah, we did that a while back.
So I mean, you pull it off and it sounds great because you have such a heavy tone of guitars. Like I have a show on Octane and I played the new Fozzy tune and I followed up with Animals.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, I got a lot of positive response. People, we haven't heard Nickelback on Octane in a while.
Yeah, cool.
There
yeah,
you go, boys.
Really came, stood up
Thank
and
you.
That was very
but that's
nice
a killer
you.
Tune,
Thank
and it's fast and this cool bass line and like really like Bon Scott lascivious lyrics that has a story where you get busted by the dad at the end. I'm like, this is great. You know, it's a great tune.
It's a driving tune. It's a tune to get speeding tickets.
That's
to.
Right. That's
you
right.
Know, it's funny how like the songwriting of that song was actually quite hilarious. We had 3 days left for the album, and there was. I think on the chart in the wall it was D dot doot dot da D dot. That was the name of the song. And
we're missing the title
and we were panicking time, yeah. Because we had to go on tour, we'd leave and or album delivery was this day or something, and literally it was like 2 or 3 days. Chad grabbed the CD of the music, sat in the car, wrote the lyrics in about an hour, came back up, and I was like blown away at that. It was like it was very, very
They're really good.
It was well done and that kind of thing. But to back to what you're saying about playing heavy stuff and stuff like that's we grew up on that. We grew up on like Metallica and Megadeth and Anthrax and Testament and you know.
I was listening to all the hardcore shit like you know Cro-Mags all that punk shit back then the real gritty stuff that was offensive. Like I had a massage therapist show up to my hotel room and I was listening to Cro-Mags and I had left the door like ajar so she could just come in. She came in. I was like, oh my God, I'm sorry about the music. You know, I just instantly apologize because when you listen to Cro-Mags loud, if somebody who you don't think gets it comes in, you apologize.
You apologize.
Because it's just like, oh, I'm sorry I did that to you. You know, this isn't for you. I'm sorry.
I remember I bought Number of the Beast at a comic book shop, probably 1986 or 7. And I put it on. Of course, we all know the song. And then, of course, right when the chorus is going on, my mom comes in the room. She's like, you have to turn that off. I'm like, the whole album isn't like this. Honest, it's not. I'm sorry. I won't play Number of the Beast in the house anymore. Because you feel bad because other people are listening, right?
Oh, for sure. The devil, the best marketing man in the world.
Devil music.
Let's
yes.
talk about when I was going through some of your tunes. Just kind of like I always kind of like listen to some tunes and remember stuff. I forgot the song that I heard every Monday night for probably eight years.
Oh yes,
Burn It to the Ground.
Right,
which
about
is
that.
Another killer riff and a great chorus was the theme of Raw for I don't know, was it 8 years, 7 years, 5 years?
Oh,
sure,
I
felt
know.
Like a long ass time.
Yeah, sure, no. it was six
Talk
months,
about,
Chris. That's how bad it was.
I'm kidding.
I'll get Chad to give you a written apology here for this. And,
I don't even know how long it was. That was really, really nice of them to select and get behind that song. I think it did us a lot of favor.
Does that help? I mean, obviously, I'm sure it helps the song and helps the band when
absolutely,
oh,
absolutely,
show
absolutely, like all that kind of stuff. Familiarity with that is it definitely
is it
went up a ton
that you knew about. Did you submit the song or did you just get a call one day saying, "Hey, guys"?
I think it was.
I don't know.
I'm not sure how that went down, whether it was solicited or whether somebody asked us. That's a good question. I'm not sure. It was through Roadrunner at the time. But I know that when they came to ask us, we were just like, oh, yeah, of course, that'd be a great idea. And it seems to make sense. So it's just alive, motivating. You know, you obviously,
it really
I can explain it all I want, but you listen to it, you feel it. It's like, that's how it was written. You know, when we were in the studio, we were trying to get, Mutt was trying to get these, Mutt Lang, when we were producing that one, he was like, let's get these haze.
And, so fun.
And I remember, doing that, it's hilarious. We'd be talking about stuff and he's like, oh, we should have some gang vocals in here. Let's go. And he can grab me and go in there. And I'm just sitting there and I'm like, I'm going to sing backup gangs next to Mutt. Mutt's like an awesome singer.
Oh, dude.
I think he grabbed my brother for one incredible. Of them too, bro. I'm not sure if he's on that one or what, but there was like, four or five of us in this tiny little one person vocal booth doing these gang vocals for it. But it just all made sense. It all came together really well. And it's supposed to be that live, energetic song. And man, it really translated.
How was it working with Mutt Lange? I forgot that you guys were with him. Mm. What record was that?
Dark Horse.
That was another big one for you guys.
Yeah, it worked well.
Mutt
was really great. I love Mutt. I think it was definitely nice. We had done, I think Silver Side Up was the last one we had done with the producer. So we did The Long Road on our own and we did All the Right Reasons on our own. And so we knew that we were looking at, can we play video games here?
Don't worry about that.
Okay. Mutt Lang's on the phone.
Mutt Lang's, ears are burning. But yeah, so we decided to work with the producer at that point. And I won't go through the whole story, but he actually took our call and was like, yeah, I totally want to work with us. And that was fantastic because we were all huge fans. Us at the time were like, I think when we started listening, really digging into music, it would have been, I know Hysteria was the first one I remember that was just had such an impact. But going back to AC/DC, Back in Black and The Cars and Foreigner.
The Shania stuff is her. Brian Adams, Waking Up the Neighbors.
Huge album, great album too. So we were just stoked that he wanted to come work with us. So great songwriter, great collaborator for producing as well. Like he just, and an amazing singer. At 9 in the morning, man, he could just
incredible.
Like it's unbelievable. I couldn't tell the difference between him and Brian Adams sometimes. He's got such a
strong voice. You know what's so funny is you're so right about this, and I've really started noticing it on the AC/DC records. Mm. Giving the Dog a Bone, that chorus, it's all Mutt Lange. Go listen to it. Mm. Giving the Dog a Bone, giving the dog. It might as well be from Hysteria. And the other one is Touch Too Much. If you listen to that chorus, there's no way it's Malcolm and Angus going, Touch Too Much. It's all him. I'm like, you can take that exact voice, put it on Hysteria, put it on, Man, You Make Me Feel Like a Woman, put it on all this stuff, put it on your albums. He does a lot of vocals on every record that he produces.
I always wonder why he did. I asked him, why don't you play in a band? He being a phantom.
He was a bass player in a band in the 70s.
Yeah, okay. I know.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
But ever since, since his career started going really well, is kind of what I was talking about.
Oh.
he's like, this is all right. This is good.
It's like, how about this? Mutt Lange plays in the band with Desmond Child. Yep. It's the biggest band of all time, right?
Right?
Yeah. Some guys behind the scenes, I guess, Yeah. So as we start to wind down here, we're talking about the longevity of the band and how big you guys still are, even though radio is not as much of a factor for you guys anymore, because the business has changed as well, right? So what is your business model now? Because it's not so much radio-wise. You still put out the records and just go on tour and the fans just keep coming, and that's how it works at this point in time?
As far as business models go, I think we have to do what we've kind of done the whole time, which is learn what to do.
Interesting.
And then do it. Yeah. Because we can't operate like we operated even on the last album. This stuff's changing so fast.
Now, how do you mean by that?
Just the way that music gets out to people is different now. The way that you get yourself out to people, you can break it down simplistically to record, tour, but there's also how do you bring it to the people? How do you interface with your people? How do you get it out there? Is radio is irrelevant. Mm. The streaming services
unless
are...
Unless you're a band ours, radio really helped us get known. Mm-hmm. But I can see what you're saying on your end. For bands growing, it helps a lot.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
For bands that are already built.
For sure.
Got your say.
It is really, really hard for rock bands to get on the radio.
Sure it is.
For you to get radio is spectacular.
It's hard. Yeah.
It's very, very difficult. For every one rock band that gets on the radio, there's 10,000 that want that to don't, and can't. Yeah. But I, you know,
so the, streaming is different.
The,
you were saying
streaming's different, and that's different than downloads was, and you know, we have to constantly be evolving with the world we're in, because every record to record, it's different every time. Mm-hmm. So we're gonna have to learn again,
mm-hmm,
and continue to learn.
Yeah, it's a whole new world. Like, I mean, on so many facets, because, like, yeah, I don't know. I'm still, you know, for a sweet callback, I'm still a dinosaur listening to.
Nice one.
You like that?
Yeah. Nice.
Very good, man. Very good.
Sandwiches.
Sandwiches. Sentences.
You're still listening to the dinosaurs?
Yeah. Well, I still do it. You know, listen to certain stations for different reasons sometimes than just keeping current. But I mean, ask anybody. Like, you've got kids. I've got kids, and I'm like, my kid's 16. I've got another kid that we basically adopted into the family. He's like 21, 22. Mm. So I kind of get this range, demographic range, as to like, where do you get your music? And by that, I started like, do you even listen to radio?
Mm.
And they're like, no, not like, obviously phones. They listen to their phones or computers or
YouTube.
Their friends or YouTube. And it can come from a blurb on Instagram. It doesn't necessarily mean that right. That could be the way it comes. It's delivered, right? That's how you service your music. Sometimes we're finding like we're right in the middle of doing, and we kind of previewed it last year, a documentary on us, and it's kind of strange because it evolved from an EPK,
right?
Going
electronic press kit
is what they call it, which is like, hey, here's
the, that's back when electronic was like a thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Ooh, I want some. It's put called this cassette in.
Digital.
It's not a stack of papers anymore.
But it's funny, and this is kind of how we've kind of worked through the years too, is that we saw this digital press kit for Feed the Machine, and it was supposed to be 15 minutes. We looked at it like, holy, that's actually some fantastic footage. Like, got the cameras going, that looks great, maybe we just get them film a little more on the road and just hang on to it for a second, and then we'll just film a little more, and then let's just do a little more, and then it just started kind of snowballing, and it's becoming some kind of, I wanted to have a bit of a history just for us, just for our family to see, this is what's happened,
mm-hmm,
this is where we are now, and da 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 da. But it's starting to kind of turn into something besides a just kind of a chronological history of the band. Now it's this kind of, It's a bit different. So and that also is another way to reach people these days, is through videos, TV, not music videos, but just like personal interest stuff.
The story of the band. Yeah.
And it's not, it's just started as I wanted to have something, conversations with us together. Those are the best things, when you find, instead of individual sit downs, it feels like an interview. But when you actually chat about stuff, you kind of dig up other things. So I found it completely fascinating this whole time as well. So, yeah, you got to get creative. You got to dip and slide.
Yeah, you got to stay ahead of the curve, right?
Yeah. And it's been fun. That part's been fun doing it. So maybe we'll drop that sometime in a bit here, and we'll try to compete with the Jonas Brothers documentary. And see
good luck.
compete with the Jonases.
No way.
I saw you watching the Kiss video, Mike, with a big smile on your face. You guys ever tour with Kiss or play any shows with them?
We played one show with Kiss.
Big show.
On the New Year's Eve of Y2K, when everybody's toaster was going to take over their house.
Yeah,
we were on stage with these guys, and the reason I was smiling was because I had a little internal monologue, because there's this one scene in, what is this, Rock and Roll All Night video,
it's made it, yeah,
and there is a scene where the camera is on the guys and they're talking, and then it sort of like pans them out of the frame, and it's just some girl walking away in a bikini.
It's from the Exposed video.
Yeah. And I'm like, so what you're saying is, if we do what you do, we'll get those.
Yeah. Oh. Isn't that always the way, though? If I play this guitar,
of course,
do that.
That's what that's why all these women are half naked walking through the video. It's like, this is what yes, we
this
do.
This is it. Yeah.
Is that the only reason you're here, Mike?
Chicks, man.
Well, all right.
When you guys were starting out, who were some of the bands that took you out on tour?
When we started out early, a band called Big Sugar.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
Big Sugar.
Big Canadian band. Yeah,
that was actually a really. Great. Like, we got a lot of
under the band that never really cracked the states.
Yes, from that, exactly, right? Yeah. And good albums too. Like,
I really thought they were going to. I really thought that they were going to open it up.
Yeah,
you know? Yeah,
yeah. Just one of those things that didn't quite.
Big Wreck too.
Big Wreck. We did. Some
Big
stuff.
Wreck. We played with them a lot, and that's another one that I was like, these guys are just stars. Yeah. They're stars, and it's going to break. You know, to quote one of their songs, is going to be blown wide open because they're so good. Mm. You know, they're just so good.
They formed a super group called Big Sugar Wreck, I heard.
Big Sugar Wreck.
Yeah, that's what I heard. I'm not sure if that's true.
We'll all find out about that.
Look it up, man.
Yeah.
Because you guys haven't really opened for anybody in a long time. It's been headlining everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We did a run with Bon Jovi.
Ooh, that was fun.
How was that?
It's good. It was really great.
Learning curve there. Yeah.
I mean, like they go to Europe and stuff, and they're just like stadiums, and it's like it was fantastic. It was great. They're all super nice to us and great shows. And
what's your biggest country outside of the States?
Germany's pretty good for us. Let me think. UK's pretty good.
UK's good.
Australia's pretty good.
What's the place that's tough really to say. Good?
Got a great worldwide fan base all across the board.
Yeah, I mean, I wish there were more places to play in Japan. Japan's a lot of fun, too.
Japan's fun.
That's probably good.
That's good.
Greenland.
Nice.
Let's stay topical, all right?
Yeah.
Actually, no.
Reykjavik.
We've never been there. Yeah. I want to go to Reykjavik. I'm trying to figure out some kind of skeleton.
But that's Iceland, system. You see. That's
That'll
Iceland.
Be the next one.
Oh,
like,
I know it is.
It's not Greenland.
No, I've actually been there. I saw you've got a nice place to play there, actually.
That'll be the next one. Yeah, guys, we got another couple of days with Nickelback for Fozzie. It's in Greenland.
Yeah.
Like, I was there. I was there when he wanted to talk about it.
I was there when there were icebergs. They actually had icebergs.
I'm still stewing on trying to figure out what's the big... But we're not like that band that's like, you know... There's a lot of bands, a lot of artists that are like... Yeah, I do okay here, but I'm big in Japan.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like we're kind of like.
So you guys got to like Kid Rock. We did a tour with Steel Panther in Australia and Kid Rock was opening for Bon Jovi. Mm. And the reason why he took the gig was because his girlfriend wanted to go to Australia. He's like, yeah, you know, it's only $100,000 a show, but my girlfriend wanted to come to Australia. He said, I never wanted to come to Australia. He goes, I can sell out Louisville. Why the fuck do I want to come to Australia? And I thought about it. And his mindset, his point is I can sell out in the States.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why do I want to go? You know, 20 hours down the road to do the same
thing. That's kind of my understanding of his sort of idea of his career is, you know, to stick to America.
It's America,
To get him to Canada is a stretch, right?
Yeah.
He has never attempted the rest of the world just because he's got it kind of made.
Mm-hmm. Everybody has their own plan, man.
And I understand,
you know,
I understand what he's thinking. Some people don't want to go someplace where you need a translator or order breakfast. You know, I'm
that doesn't
into
work
it.
For me though.
I'm into it.
You like going around?
Traveling?
I love going around.
I love going around.
So I come home and I'm bored
when you guys started, how old were you? Early 20s?
As the band?
Yeah,
I was 23. So Mike was 39. And
currently 95 years old. Yes,
looking good. Don't look a day over 70.
Yeah, thank you.
The thing. I've been doing this since I was 19, and whether it was living in Okotoks and driving to Rimby or Cochrane or whatever it was, you're still on the tour, right? Yeah. I got a weekend of shows. It doesn't just go away.
Yeah,
you need to stay home more. Yes, I do, but I still got to go do shit and see things and play, you know, and do stuff, right?
It's a weird thing. It's almost like a learned thing, I suppose. Like you, again, you obviously know that traveling, living on a suitcase, it's just, you just do it and luckily I'm married to somebody who just is like all about that too.
Yeah.
Probably, if
she's a traveler, your wife.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it goes to a lot of different places, but so it really, really works for us.
That's really cool, man.
Yeah, it's great.
Last question for you. After all these years of playing, what's your favorite songs to play live?
Other people's songs.
That was going to be my answer.
None of ours.
Favorite song to play live? That's a good question.
So I was looking at your set list the other day. It was one that was on the floor. I just happened to walk by. I think it was from a couple shows ago. Mm. And he's like, yeah, I know like a bunch of Nickelback songs, but I'm looking at the set, like, well, I know all the Nickelbacks. I know that one and that one and that one. Yeah. And that one. Oh, wow, I forgot about that one. I didn't know about that one.
See, that's a struggle for me personally, because I like to play the songs people recognize and stuff. And for sure, I mean, that's got to happen, because I wouldn't want to go to a show with my favorite band. They play all B-sides. And it's come on. But I mean, and I don't even mean B-sides, but we do have a lot of like songs that we used to play, because when you start, as you know, with the State, we played all of them.
Yes.
And so we're set up. We played almost all of them. And so there's a bunch that we hadn't played. We just put a song called Hangnail back in the set, which I really like, because it's just kind of, meat and potatoes rock tune, which I really like to play. Mm-hmm. I like playing Someday. And, you know, Burn It to Ground is always fun for sure for a rock song. But Gotta Be is just like musically, I like the harmonies and stuff. I really, I dig that.
How about you?
Musically, I find it kind of hard to choose one, but for the live experience itself, I really enjoy, I have kind of a perception of this, and I don't know if it's right or not, but when we play Million Miles an Hour, I really like to play that song a lot because it's kind of a heavy metal song. It's a hard driving song, and I get to, it's like, it's kind of like being in a fight. You know, it sounds like what a fight feels like. Mm-hmm. But what we did is we programmed a light show for that song and a video content for that song that is basically an assault. And I really enjoy watching the confusion in the audience because they're just like, oh God, what's happening to me? Like they, you know, when we first started playing it, I remember Chad and Ryan were like, the people, they just stand there. They're not that into it. And I'm like, no, they're under attack. They don't know what to do. You know, because we, if you can, check it.
I'm watching the show tonight. Yeah.
Visually, literally all hell's breaking loose. And we're not even using pyro right now, but it is... It's War of the World shit, you know, and I like that a lot.
That's killer, man. Well, I'm going to watch the show from the side stage tonight. Can you guys get me a pass?
I'll talk to a guy. I know
stage
a guy.
Stage pass, maybe?
You'll have to give it back when you're done, though.
Yeah. Oh, no problem, man. A crew pass. I'll photocopy it.
You can bring anybody you want. No dudes.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.